I believe the topic was something to the effect of price fraud and the ethical and halachic issue that one encounters, whether you're the seller or the buyer, when there is unintentional fraud going on. And let's explain how you could have unintentional fraud and see both from the ethical standpoint and certainly the halachic standpoint of how we would come out. So this is an actual case that happened. I know the person that happened to himself, I know him personally. He was traveling abroad and he went into a jewelry shop. And while his wife was shopping elsewhere, he came across this beautiful piece of jewelry. I think it was a bracelet. And he sees the price of the bracelet, $20,000. He says his wife's going to love it. He's going to take it. He buys the piece of jewelry. Later on, presents it to his wife. Wonderful. She loved it. A few days later, he gets a call from the owner of this jewelry store. Mr. So-and-so, a terrible mistake has happened. My girl at the counter mispriced the bracelet. And in fact, it was not supposed to be $20,000, but it was supposed to be $100,000. Ooh, that's a big difference. That's a big difference. Listen, that was the price, and it was marked up at that. And that's what he bought it for. It was a sale, fair and square. This is what happened. Okay, so he goes back to his wife. He says, do you really like that the bracelet, or maybe you want to exchange for something else? No, I really like it. Oh. Okay, so what would we say in such an instance? What would we say in such a case? No fault of his own. He bought the bracelet fair and square, and he paid the price that was marked on this item. Is there anything wrong halachically? Is anything wrong ethically with this person keeping the bracelet? What would we say?
I wouldn't think so.
You would think it's okay for him to keep it?
Yes.
Are you wearing your rabbi's hat now or your lawyer's hat now? Oh, your lawyer's hat now. Okay.
That doesn't seem ethically correct.
A person can make a mistake.
He has taken advantage of a mistake.
He didn't take advantage. He didn't know.
Yeah,
he knows.
But if he knew it was a $100,000 necklace,
right?
If he knew it was a $100,000, if we get back to the expectation thing,
we would have said
right. If he knew it was a $100,000 bracelet, and it was clearly wrongly marked at $20,000, okay, I would think it was a different situation. But here, even though expectation was worth more, that's what it was priced.
Right.
He bought it, and he changed his position by virtue of having bought it. He gave it to his wife.
Well, it's irrelevant. If he relied to his detriment on the price, that would be one thing.
Hey, if you give your wife something, we'll take it back.
Yeah, right. You're you know, $80,000 is $80,000. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying if it was something small, but something like that. You know, if you went and sold it to a third party and that person bought it or something, that's a whole bunch. What I'm saying is all about reliance. If you talk about, reliance and what the real harm is, it depends on to what extent you...
Invert the case. Invert the case. I accidentally priced it at $100,000. I meant to price it at $20,000.
Am I going to call him?
The fellow agreed to pay.
Right.
He paid.
Is the owner of the store Jewish or not?
That is a good question.
The other thing is the foregoing opportunity. Let's say it wasn't jewelry, but it was something important for his business, and he went and bought this because it was at the right price, and he foregone the opportunity to buy a similar piece of equipment that would have been more expensive, but now that other piece is no longer available. But I'm just saying, right, but that's talking about relying, reasonable reliance to your detriment. So you have to, was it reasonable? Did he rely? A, B, was it reasonable? And C, was it to his detriment?
Okay. So this is scenario number one.
Okay.
Scenario number two, You're house shopping, looking for a new house. A realtor shows you a lovely house, mild, looks good, the right size, right condition. Okay, you put it in the house, you get it, you buy the house fair and square. Who does this house belong to? Well, actually, there was an old woman who lived there for many years. She actually built the house 75 years ago, lived there all her life, and now she passed away, and her children are selling the house. They don't need it, so they sell the house. Fair and square, it was the fair value market of the house, and it was found. Fine. A few months later, you're getting ready to move into the house, and you're putting in some new carpet, and you rip up the old carpet, and you see in the floorboard, you find a safe, a diamond ring. You find a diamond ring in the floorboard. Okay? So, usually when they pass you notes, it means you have 3 minutes left. I just started. Oh, okay. So in that case, do you have to call up the children and say, hey, you know, this obviously belonged to your mother, who was the only one who lived in this house prior to the sale, right? It's not like, well, it could have been six other people who lived here first. No, we know who lived here from the start. Do you have to call them up and say, you know, this is rightfully yours, or do you get to keep it?
You have to return it. It's, I mean, at least in American life, if you look at a standard agreement of sale, it's not a fixture. The contract was just for selling, you know, the real estate and maybe other things, but this was not contemplated in the original
agreement of sale.
As is only applies to the condition of the real estate. It doesn't talk about, it doesn't contemplate something like finding, you know, rings and other aspects of it.
In other words, if the children would come in, they say, oh, you know, we sold you that as is, but there's this sentimental mirror of our mother's that we really wanted to keep, the buyer would have a much stronger argument to be able to keep that mirror. Because I bought the house with everything in it. But this was something that was unknown to everyone. It was unknown to the seller, it was unknown to the buyer. It was probably unknown to the woman herself, because if she would have known about it, she probably would have told this to her children. Her heirs didn't know about it, so she also probably forgot about it.
But it belongs to her. It's not like finding minerals.
Correct. No, that's clear. That it was an owner. It was a knowable owner at one point in time. Now, the truth is, from a Jewish standpoint, there's no difference when it comes to fraud. There's no difference if the fraud is an item that's $5.99 or $599 or $5 million. There's no difference.
Excuse me, are you saying it's an affirmative obligation?
What?
There's an affirmative obligation on the person who buys the house who finds the ring to return the ring. It's not... I'm just trying to understand.
An affirmative obligation means it's written somewhere, right, that you need to...
No, it can be affirmative in the law. It doesn't have to be written anywhere. But
not affirmative.
It's not affirmative. But they wouldn't have a defense.
So if it was... Well, I don't know about the law. I mean, yeah, no, I do know about the law. I would say that, yes, it belongs to the person. I mean, it's not... if you look at... Of course, it's contractual. If you look at the agreement of sale...
Let's assume the agreement of sale is as you said it was.
Right, okay. Standard
ring and set. All right, he finds the diamond ring. Is it your understanding under American law, the Pennsylvania law, he's an affirmative obligation to return the ring?
I don't think so.
So it's a question as to whether he's a defense, whether the purchase of the property was a defense to the claim or not by the third party. But it's different because I'm thinking when we're getting into the ethical aspects of it, it's much different whether you have an affirmative defense or a defense of the claim.
Right.
Or maybe Joe Lieberman's position. Don't ask, don't tell. We'll know about the ring. You know, okay.
It's no longer
the law. Okay. So... Again, when it comes to Jewish law, there's no difference. There's no difference. Well, it's only a small item. It's a few dollars. What's the difference? Both the few items or the few million-dollar item would have to go to a court or go to a rabbinic court, those that are scholarly enough to understand the case and be able to adjudicate on it. And that's what would have to be done in any case. So this, just let me cite two interesting examples which are interesting from an American standpoint, American law, which certainly the Torah law would agree with these two cases. And the one is, there was a woman, Marlene, who discovered 6 cartons of orange juice, which had been incorrectly marked at a price much lower than the regular one. And she wanted to buy it, stock up. However, the cashier refused to sell her the juice at that price. He said it was mismarked, and she claimed, but this is what it was marked at. I should be able to buy it at that price. And the cashier said, no, it was mismarked. We don't want to sell you that price. So this is the law from the government of Saskatchewan. I don't know if every place holds like this, but this is the it was. I bring this because it's an interesting. That one?
It was the coffee machine.
Oh. Okay. Well, it must be an expensive recorder then. Tells you when your coffee's ready. Their position is that the price on an item, and again, this is before you buy, the price in an item, the price marked is only an invitation and not an offer to sell. It's an invitation, you may buy it at this price if we want to sell it. But then the cashier, who's in all good faith working for the owner, said, oh, you know what, we don't want to sell you at that price because it's the wrong price. We're not obligated to sell this. We think, well, any item in a supermarket, is if it's there to buy, as soon as I take it, I'm willing to pay for it. No, if it's mismarked, they have a right to withhold the sale on this item because it was mismarked. That's the way they call it. It's an invitation to buy the item, and they don't have to sell it. Therefore, they're not beholden to that price. Fine. That's if, that if it is the case if it takes place before the sale. Here's another case that took place after the sale. And what happened was, someone went to Walmart, and they saw an item that was normally priced, should have been priced at around $60, they saw it for $30. Instead of $59.99, it was $29.99. It's great. That's what the sticker says. That's where she bought it, and she put it in her cart. After she bought the item, she looked at her ticket and said, whoa, I paid a lot more money than I should have figured out. She went back to the cashier, and the lady said, take it to customer service. I can't do anything over here. Customer service, they sent someone to the aisle, and they said, yeah, indeed, it was marked. All the items in that all those items were marked at $29.99, and the cashier, when they scanned it, but the barcode came out to $59.99. Okay, so it was obviously just a mistake that whoever labeled those price stickers made a mistake. So the question here was posed: Is she allowed to get it for the $29.99 price or the $59.99 price?
Well, I have a question. Is the $29.99 was a correct price, but when they scanned the computer in the store wasn't changed to reflect the new price?
Or no.
$29 was clearly a mistake.
It was a mistake. Yeah, it was indeed $59.99, and that's why it came up scanned that way. Yeah. So she thought she got a great bargain. And meanwhile, it was a mispriced by whichever person was pricing the items.
Now, wait a minute. They were aware enough not to change the price in the computer, but they did change the price on their shelves.
Yeah, somebody made a mistake.
Well, the initial mistake of fact. One person thought the price was one thing, one person thought the price was the other, so is there a contract?
Yeah, and it's clear that it was a mistake, and that's what the customer service desk told her. It was a mistake. Whoever put those stickers on made a mistake, because you see clearly in the computer we had a different price. So there's one woman wrote back that she's a customer service associate at Walmart, and they obviously have some latitude to make decisions on their own. She says, my policy is that any item that's mismarked, I give it to the customer at that price. If it was our fault, we'll swallow the loss. That's the item priced at that amount. That's what the customer thought it was. That's what I would give it to. She says a lot of people try to pull fast ones. Some of them lie. They saw a different price. Most of them don't read the signs. But if indeed it was an honest mistake all around and the person thought they were buying it, she would refund them in full or give them a tip at that price. Now, we would also, if a store has a policy, from the Torah standpoint, if the store has a policy, and that's the policy they made up, that certainly would be okay. So even though they mismarked it, if I know that's the policy, and I already have had this experience, so I know from calling up Walmart that that's their policy, then ethically, I don't have to go back. It could be I bought a few items, and it was all mismarked, and that's the price I bought it at. Since I know that's their policy, I won't have to go back and return it.
Why isn't that standard?
If somebody has a garage sale, right?
That's different. And it's a store, that's a business. I mean, of course, you're just getting rid of, odds and ends.
Right, but if their policy is that any mistake they make, and there are many stores, usually the larger chains, the chain stores that could afford it, but if they say an item that's mismarked, some of them give away for free, and some of them you take it at that lower price.
I have a garage sale where the guy pays $4 for a frame, and the worthless painting inside the frame turns out to be a Rembrandt.
Right.
Which happens from time to time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're an ethical person and you know that you've got something for improper price,
that's the power of good question.
You shouldn't feel like you've taken advantage.
Well, presuming that if I would go back to the customer service and say, this is what happened, and they would say, well, our policy is that you can keep it, so...
It's okay.
So that's okay. I mean, if it's okay with them, it certainly should be okay with me. You know, I don't have to be more religious than they are. if they're okay with that, I don't have to be more ethical than they are. In terms of if that's that's we would say that is certainly within the parameters of ethical.
From their perspective, they would say it was good market.
Yeah, they probably, that's right. They probably made that decision based on overall they'll gain more that way by having that attitude. Okay. So again, we have to come to some sort of understanding in the case of the mismarked jewelry, and then the diamond ring. The example we gave found under the floorboard in the house that was bought for the fair market value. So now let's switch to a strictly halachic view of things. The Torah tells us very clearly, in Parshas Bahar, that when one sells an item, when one buys an item, both the seller and the buyer may not defraud. Can't overprice it, can't underprice it, you can't underpay. And if there's such a gap in the price, whether it's overpaid or underpaid, there's a certain calculation the Talmud, the Gemara gives, and if it's more than a sixth overpriced or less than a sixth underpriced of the fair market value or what that item should have costed, then the sale is nullified. And the seller has the right to call that in and say it was underpriced by more than a sixth. And the sale is void, and the buyer, if he realized afterwards, someone tells him, that's how much you paid, you overpaid it, the item, let's say, was mismarked, you overpaid, he has a right, he has a certain amount of time, he has the amount of time that he would have to look into it and ask around, and then he has that right to exchange the item, give it back and get a full refund for his money. Okay, if it's within a very small marginal difference, so then the sale remains, and if the buyer wants to keep the item, he can keep the item and then just pay the difference. And the seller, the same way, if the seller was underpriced and the seller realized it, but if it's small margin, then the same thing would be. The sale is final, and the difference just has to be paid out.
Is there a concept of change of position or reliance? Let's assume the guy buys the machine for more than 1/6 below its cost. And the seller, under those circumstances, would have the right to call it back. But when he bought it, he spent 3 times that amount to install it in this factory. And now it's installed and it's operating. Right? Does he have to bear the loss of taking it out and returning it when he bought it in good faith?
So the buyer bought it in good faith and he underpaid for it.
He underpaid by more than a sixth.
Mm-hmm. And now...
But based on that, he installed this equipment at a great expense in his back.
And if it was reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the
right.
story, though, about the you build a house and the stone in the bottom is improperly obtained? You can't just pay for it. You actually have to take the house apart and give it back.
So, I mean, there must be a sense of reliance as an offset.
Mm-hmm.
Stop. The story goes the other way, though.
That's the word. I need a word for that.
Right. In that case, I don't know. Because usually collateral damage that occurs based on something that's unknown by people in this case would not be the loss of the seller. So even though the person bought a machine in good faith but underpaid for it, the seller should have a right to ask for it back and give a full refund. What that person did with afterwards should not be a concern of the seller.
Because the seller can the buyer obviate the claim by paying him the difference?
Oh, in that case.
Yeah. Or is the seller entitled to the machine back?
Oh, the halakha would say the sale is void.
The sale is void.
Sale is void.
So he's entitled to the machine back.
Yeah. He has to give back the money he was paid.
Even though the buyer offers to pay him the difference.
Right. He can then go, he can rebuy it.
I would appeal. Yeah, I think I'd argue that.
That's true.
Higher
God.
Have you thought of something the rabbis haven't discussed?
I mean, the law typically wants stability. That's really what the law generally requires. Fairness or not, it wants stability. It wants predictability. So you would think that when there's a significant change of position, by virtue of something, you could at least make it up with a fair monetary thing.
Mm-hmm.
But here you're saying no, he's entitled to get his machine back.
Right.
That's scary.
And as we view it as if we just have to push the clock backwards. We just, everything is void.
People to their original position.
Put everyone to their position. Well, yeah, and then if he wants to buy, he can buy it.
This is what the rabbis say. Right, this isn't...
Oh, no, we're not saying this is...
Right, I mean, this is fair. I'm just so you mean, has this issue even been addressed? This hypothesis that he's suggesting, has it been discussed to your knowledge? And they've actually said that if somebody relies on it and, you know, reasonably, I'm not using American legal standards, common law, but, you know.
Right. So there's a similar issue. I thought that's what was brought up by the gentleman to your left. With the stone. Yeah, so actually the rabbinic law in that case is the case is talking about it would be similar to our case. Somebody stole from his friend. Okay. And he stole, in the case of the Talmud, he stole beams from his friend. And then he built a house with those beams. Right. So if he's got to give back those actual beams, right, he'll never fess up to the fact that he stole them. So in order for people to admit where they wronged or admit to paying underpaying what they should have, so we said you don't have to give back the item already. If so much has been done, you can keep the item and just pay the difference. Right. So that's what he's saying. So in that case, could very well be, since let's say he already installed the machine somewhere, to extract it out and take it out would be, so then we probably will let him pay the difference in that case.
But then you also have the issue of a good faith third party purchaser for value. I feel like they secure transactions again. This is like, if the guy builds the house with the beams that he stole and he sells it to a third party who purchased the house in good faith for reasonable, you know, and should they be prejudiced because they rely, you know, reasonably, they did all their title research or whatever, and they purchased the house for value.
Can a thief ever have value? Can you ever have title? Can a thief ever get good title?
Well, that's why you have title insurance. I mean, let's say in a world without title insurance.
Right, so the buyer then will be able to go back to the thief.
There. But does the person who purchased it in good faith and they forewent? For another opportunity, struggling on another opportunity,
you know, and they're now to their even to their detriment, they would still the house would still have to go back to the person who owned the beams, or the beams would have to be removed, or how would that work? Or I would think that the thief that the person was originally stolen from, their recourse would have to be against the individual, but not against you know the house or the property.
Right. That's correct. That's correct. They would have full recourse against the person who sold it. Yeah, and he would have to pay whatever whatever was paid for the house and whatever value it is now. So that's the Torah law. Very clearly, you can't defraud someone, both on the seller's part and the buyer's can't defraud. So again, if it's a margin of 6%, the sale is void. Less than that, the sale remains, but you have to pay the difference. So, what's the percentage if someone buys an item of $100,000, buys it only for $20,000?
Obviously more.
Well, now, obviously more. So, from a Torah standpoint, it would be null and void. However, there are certain things that are not that the laws of defrauding do not pertain to. One of them is real estate. Why? Because real estate can fluctuate and it depends where and when. And therefore they said the laws of the laws of defrauding don't apply to buying property, buying a piece of real estate. It also doesn't apply to things that don't have necessarily a marketable value. For example, let's say antiques. Right, so really, it could depend. Some people will pay a lot more. So you can't say, well, a bicycle from Walmart, people will pay somewhere between $60 and $80. But an antique from 500 years ago, you know, you could have people pay $10,000, people paying $50,000, right? So let's say it was an item like that. Let's say this jewelry was an antique, which could have had a fluctuation of price, and therefore there would not be restraint to the laws of defrauding. What will be in that case? So here we have another idea in the Talmud, and that's expressed as follows. The woman in the shop was not the owner of the jewelry. She was merely a proxy. She was an agent of the owner selling the item of jewelry. And therefore, whenever I have an agent performing a transaction for me, I always have the right to say, you were only my agent for my benefit and not for my detriment. And therefore, if the agent, either knowingly or unknowingly, it was an honest mistake, or it was a misjudgment, and they wronged me, halakhically speaking, I always have the right to say, she or he was only, it was merely an agent, and therefore I'm not beholden to the transaction that agent did. And therefore, in this case, even though, so number one, from the standpoint of the Torah, that there was defrauding here, again, defrauding doesn't have to be intentionally and maliciously, but there was defrauding in the price, therefore, certainly the sale was void unless the person wanted to pay the rest. And in this case, in an additional factor, there was only an agent that was doing the sale. And since the agent was doing the transaction, whenever it's to the detriment of the sender of this agent, you could always make it void.
Does it go to the price or does it go to the value? For example, suppose he sells the house and there's termites in the house. And therefore, the price that the guy paid for the house, and the house may fall down.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Is it absolute? In other words, does it matter whether he knew there were termites or didn't know there were termites? Is it still fraud or does it just deal with the price of goods?
You're talking about in the case where, because real estate doesn't have defrauding on it? No.
Well, even that, it goes to the price of, everything we've been talking about goes to the price of goods.
It was disclosure statement?
Yeah, everything has to be disclosed. Everything that has to be disclosed. And even in that case, if the...
Unless it's as is, if it's an as is agreement.
Yeah, if you buy it as is without an inspection first, without a termite inspection first, then you get it.
If you know there's termites and you don't disclose it,
yes,
I think you still have it. Even if it is as is, I think you still have liability.
Oh, that's true, and luckily speaking, also, yeah. If the seller knew there were termites, yeah, that's not what we mean that there's no defrauding by that. I'm talking about the price of that, how much it's valued at. If there's something wrong with it, that certainly has to be disclosed.
I also want to go back. You were saying fraud, knowingly, your other... Isn't See, knowing, I mean, you can't have fraud. If you're not, if there's no intent, you can't have fraud. It might be a mistake or something.
Fraud, much more loose.
Just like,
he's using it more
loose. Like, we'll call them not defrauding, we'll call it mispricing. If an item is mispriced, whether it's by a sixth, whether above or below the market value of that price, so then the seller in one case and the buyer in the other case can make the sale void. So in this case, really, the seller of the jewelry could have voided the whole sale. And indeed, the person what happened to was an honest person, and he said, that's what you said, it was mispriced. Give me time and I'll pay the rest of it. And that's what he did. He did. He slowly paid away until he paid the rest of the price.
Yeah, she might have felt differently had she known it cost him $100,000.
That could be, but I'm not sure if he ever told her. So don't tell her either, okay?
But the question you raised is an important question. Does it matter if the seller's Jewish?
Does it matter if the seller's Jewish?
Halachically.
Right. Yes and no. For these purposes, we always say that if there was a mistake in the item, we always give it back. If there was a mistake, and let's say the owner of the store didn't call up, but the person realized afterward that this was mispriced. He sees an identical bracelet somewhere else, and he sees it marked at 100,000 or thereabouts. So he knows there was a. So he would then have the obligation to go. Call up, you have the halachic and the ethical obligation to call to the owner and say this was obviously mispriced. Yeah.
There's an affirmative obligation on the part of the buyer.
Correct.
Which is what we were talking about.
Correct. Yes. In this case.
Is there just one case or two?
So that would be in the first case. In the second case we gave, someone bought a house and there was a treasure under the house. There was a diamond ring found under the floorboard. Okay? It was a case, I believe this was an actual case as well. Someone was rummaging through, you know, sometimes on some Sunday in the fall, the synagogue will say, there's just old books that have been left here for years. Whoever wants it can take it, otherwise we're just going to give it away to the... They're going to bring it to the funeral home, they'll bury it, and that'll be it. So someone's rummaging around, he finds an old copy of the Rambam. The book of one of the books of Maimonides. Well, it looked pretty old, blew off the dust. I know a friend of mine, deals in antique books, an old Svarim. I'll sell it to him, maybe it's worth. Brings it over, looks at it. Yeah, alright, I'll give you $500 for it. Great, I just found the shul. They said, you know, fine. I'm so nice. I'll give $18 to the shul that shop. It's beautiful. Fine. Meanwhile, the buyer, the antique dealer, starts looking through it, and notices in some of the pages in the back, there's some writing on the side. Okay, this is a printed version of Maimonides, but there was some writing on the side. Writing? Ooh, interesting. Does a lot of research and finds out that this is the writing of the Rambah, okay, of Rav Moshe Isserles, okay, talking about the 16th century scholar, okay, a writing on the Maimonides, 12th century scholar. Whoa, now the value of this book just went up, not $500. You're talking about it can go $50,000, $100,000. You have actual writing of a great Torah scholar. Now, the buyer, the antique seller, says, ooh, this guy only sold it for $500. He didn't know, you know, that... So, his conscience tells him, you know, maybe I should really call him up. And his other side says, I'll give $18 to my shul and everything will be fine. So, in this case, you know, is he obligated to say? And this correlates very much to this case of the finding the diamond ring under the floorboard. Why? Because a very interesting in the Gemara Bava Metzia, in Tractate Bava Metzia, it has a case over there. The Mishnah states over there that if someone finds something in the wall of a house, that's the case that's given, and they used to store things in the walls of the big, the thick walls of the stone that they used to make, or under a floorboard, behind a panel. Someone finds something. The Gemara says you're allowed to keep it. Unless you're allowed to keep it, how could you keep it? Obviously, there was an owner to it. So the Gemara says, well, let's talk about that it's so rusty or so dusty, it's so old that it's clear that it's been there for hundreds of years. And of hundreds of years, that means somebody who's long dead owned it, and therefore you can keep it. Okay, one second. Someone owned this house before I bought it, right? So whoever owned this house should really be entitled to anything in the house, okay? Halachically speaking, we have various ways of acquiring items. One of those ways of acquisition is what's called a kinyan chatzir. My courtyard, my house, my property could make acquisitions for me, knowingly or unknowingly. For example, if someone decided, let's say, Bill Gates decided one Sunday a year he's flying with his private airplane and just dropping down $100 bills, only in Philadelphia. Okay? He's drinking his coffee, wondering if he's dreaming. Now, this is just a hypothetical case. Right. Oh. Anyway, $100 bills are flying through and flies through my open window. Now, my neighbor sees, whoa, this $100 was flying in. Now, he knows these are ownerless $100 bills. They're not mine, right? So, and he knows I'm not home, and he decides he knows my combination. He's my neighbor, and he comes into my house and pockets the money. Absolutely stealing. Why? I never made an acquisition. I don't even know where they're there. My house can make an acquisition for me. If that's the case, why doesn't the house make the acquisition for whoever owned the house prior to me? So why would the Mishnah say that I who bought the house and find something that's so old and so rusty that this owner never even knew about it, but certainly they bought the house and anything in the house should belong to them. And in the case of the woman who passed away, her children who inherit the house should be entitled to anything that's really valuable in the house, even though it's unknowingly, because they own the house. That's the real question on this Mishnah, this halacha. And here the early commentators, the Rishonim, explain a very interesting concept in what this acquisition of my courtyard, the kinyan chatzer that we're dealing with. And that is that it only works on something that would be common or that could be unexpected to be found. Something that would, in our best judgment, would not ever be found by this owner, it does not make it an acquisition. It's not considered his. If it's something that, well, eventually he'll get to it, he's doing the rooms, it's sitting in one of the rooms. It's an old, dusty painting, worth a lot of money, but they don't know about it yet. But eventually they'll get to it. But something that's hidden away in a place that we could say that would not be commonly found by the person does not make that acquisition. And therefore, whoever bought it after that, it's fair find, and he owns it fair and square. The halacha would say he indeed can keep it. So in this case, this is a unique case. So we know there was only one owner of the house, that being this woman, because it was built for her. She lived there. She did not know about it, and therefore, for her sake, she gave up, relinquished her ownership, gave up her rights on this diamond ring, never told it to her children. The fact that the children at one point owned the house as an inheritance from their mother, since it would never, it's an item that they would never have found, the commonly found, without ripping up the whole house, which is not an expected action, therefore, the buyer of the house indeed will be entitled to keep that ring. It would be fair and square here. It would be considered his. It's an item that he found, and there was no ownership in between the woman and this person who bought the house. And indeed, the halachic ruling in the case of this antique book of Maimonides, this old sefer that was found, since the person who took it out of the shul box and found it and then sold it, made $500 on the deal, certainly he himself would never have realized that there's much more value to this book. Therefore, it's also something that he never acquired that additional value that there is to the book, and therefore, fair and square, the person would be able to keep it. In this case, the buyer, the antique, got a good deal for himself, even though, again, maybe from a defrauding perspective, it may be a problem. We said antiques usually don't have necessary value on them. And therefore, from the case of the find, that maybe this person didn't know about it, now we say something that would not be expected or common to be found would not be considered acquired by that middle person in this case.
So may I ask, halakhically, is the state of mind relevant? I mean, you've touched on it a few times. So the
the book buyer, mm-hmm. the antiques dealer, who bought it as you described, because it was an old book, not realizing its true value, is he in a different position than the antiques buyer who recognizes that it's a $100,000 book and still offers the $500? His actions are the same in both cases.
Right, the actions are the same. But in the first case, he knows ahead of time that this is an item that he's only paying $500, which is worth really worth $50,000.
Yes.
So that would be a pure case of a fraud. So in that case, even though the buyer is knowledgeable of it and the seller has no mean intent, but in that case he would be obligated to do that. Yeah.
He has an obligation to disclose the true value before he makes an offer.
Correct. Correct. If he knows it ahead of time. That's similar to the case where I know the jewelry is worth $100,000 and the woman's saying, well, it's priced at $20,000. That would be my obligation also to say that. Correct.
So that would put, like, real estate people completely out of business.
In terms of the value of the...
Are you obligated to tell them what you think the property's worth if you're going
to... that's how the market works anyway, right? You're putting your faith in someone who is an expert here that says that, you know, this is what the house should be worth and this is what it could... go up in value over time, so you certainly have to work
you
with that.
Look up the price of similar items
yeah.
in the same area.
Correct, correct.
So what is the same as the rare book or whatever it is?
Real estate.
Who knows about something that is absolutely not discoverable within the knowledge of the seller. I mean, it's just a different case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These cases are certainly unique, but they can't come up.
Real estate. Well, let's assume the buyer is researching the property, and the buyer
real
knows...
Real estate is real estate. It's not going to be $1 billion a year instead of 10 cents a
year.
Right. I mean,
but the buyer has done research and discovered, you know what?
It's a natural guess.
He's not even right or not. Abraham Lincoln did something here, and this place may have a historical value that the seller doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to buy 100 acres right next to it, and they want this parcel, too.
Yeah, that's right. He read the paper this morning about the Hershey Estate, the Hershey School, $1,200 for the golf courses.
Very good. Okay, that concludes the presentation.
Thank you.